In a recent poll, Monty Python's Flying Circus was named the most influential comedy series in British broadcasting history. Now fans of the show can get an insider's view from Michael Palin's diaries, 1969-1979, The Python Years, just out in this country from Thomas Dunn Books. I'm delighted to welcome Michael Palin back to my show today to talk about the groundbreaking show. Hello.
Hi,
it's always a pleasure to see you.
Very nice to be here.
Have you always kept diaries?
I had a tendency to keep diary when I was young, school diaries and all that sort of thing, but never for very long. But in 1969, two things happened. I gave up smoking and I felt I needed some other obsession to counter the reaching for cigarettes all the time. I thought, oh,
something
maybe
to do with your hands?
Well, it was partly that, but I think it was something to do with my willpower, you know. If I had the willpower to give up smoking. So now I felt pretty good. What can I address this newfound strength of will to? A diary, which I'd sort of wanted to keep. And also, we'd had our first child, and I thought, well, this might be quite a nice time just to sort of document what's going on.
And coincidentally, it's just before the Monty Python project
exactly.
began,
yeah.
although it had a different name at that time. Any sense at the time that this show would be a classic or even last very long, that people might be interested in its history sometime in the future?
No, I didn't really feel that. And in fact, a lot of the early entries would be quite disappointing to real Python fans because I was more concerned about my son's first steps and first words and the kind of quality of accommodation we had on Python filming than dissecting or talking about the sketches themselves, because at the time it was just another comedy show. We thought it was good. Would anyone else think it was good? We didn't know.
And most people had real doubts at the time, which is a whole other issue.
Yeah, yeah.
But have you left everything in here?
No.
You must have taken a few personal things out.
Well, I mean, there were, I think, five times as much material. This is quite a long book, but there was five times as much in the diaries. And great chunks were taken out, family holidays, a trip Terry Jones and myself made to the States purely as a holiday.
And we still have 600-plus pages.
You still got 600-plus. An extensive index adds to that. But I suppose I've taken out one or two personal things, but I didn't tend to write very, very personal things. It was really about the events of the day, and I tried to keep that discipline and not wander off into too much analysis. Repetition of things I've taken out and all that. But
well,
basically, the feeling of it is as it was.
You mentioned Terry Jones. Before Monty Python, you were writing for TV comedy shows with Terry Jones.
Yes.
Did you begin collaborating when you were both at Oxford?
We knew each other at Oxford, and in 1964, Terry and I were two members of a four-man, one-woman review at the Edinburgh Festival. And we didn't write together then. We performed together. And I liked Terry very much. We got on well. And that show was successful enough for me to think for the first time in my life that perhaps writing and acting could be a career. So, you know, Terry and I set off on the path of script writing and comedy acting at about the same time.
But you were writing for other kinds of shows like David Frost, weren't
yeah, yeah.
you?
Yeah, yes. David Frost was quite instrumental in getting us into Python because he dreamt up, or with others, dreamt up a show called The Frost Report, a television comedy series. 1966, I think, was the first one. They took a topic each week, like authority, education, and it had quite an interesting thesis to it from a man called Tony Jay. And then a lot of sketches. And David to his great credit, brought in a whole range of writers, from old-fashioned English comedians, sort of end-of-the-pier stuff, to the new university graduates, and pushed us all together. And you were as good as whatever got accepted.
But that was mostly topical, as was That Was the Week That Was, his other series. Monty Python was not topical. The most topical things about Monty Python appear in your diary about minor strikes and other things that never make it into the show.
No, and indeed, Terry and I were not writing very good topical material. On The Frost Report, we would tend to write little fairly whimsical sort of film ideas, like a courtroom where all the judges said, court will rise, adjourn till 2 o'clock. The judges sort of go out, down some steps at the back, throw off their wigs and get on these sort of slides and carousels and all that. So silly stuff like that we were doing.
Well, what a paranoid defendant thinks judges are really doing.
Yes, exactly.
So how did you meet John Cleese and the others, Graham Chapman, Eric Idle, and Terry Gilliam?
John and Graham really through The Frost Reports. Eric I'd met slightly earlier. He was he was at Cambridge at the same time I was at Oxford. We met up at the Edinburgh Festival. Terry Gilliam, later on in 1967, Terry Jones, myself, and Eric were writing a series called Do Not Adjust Your Set, which was very sort of pre-Python. And someone said, oh, there's this American mad cartoonist. In fact, mad, he'd written for Mad Magazine, mm-hmm. So he was mad in both senses. And he would love to do some stuff for your show. And Terry did some very funny animation. Christmas cards coming to life and all that sort of stuff. And
so it was conceived from the start as a combination of live action and animation? Or was there any conception here? I mean, Monty Python was far off at the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, the form of the show was discussed. It basically came from a phone call John Cleese made to me. He said, what are you doing? And I said, well, we've done a series called Complete Not a History of Britain with Terry. He said, yes, well, you won't be doing any more of those. John, he was there, called a spade a spade. And so we said, well, let's just get all the guys from Do Not Adjust Your Set, plus you and Gray, because you write together so well. And Terry Gilliam to do some animation. Let's see what we can create. And there was John and Graham, oddly enough, were not interested in the conceptual style of it. Terry Jones was, and so was Gilliam. And they kind of thought up this stream of consciousness idea, which would enable us to use whatever funny material was around, whether or not it had a beginning, a middle, or an end, whether or not it had the sort of standard comic structure of the sketch. So that was really the revolutionary idea, I guess, and the very, very difficult one to sell to the BBC, who liked order and structure.
But the BBC had earlier had great success with The Goon Show, which was another anarchic kind of comedy show, and that did very well. It gave the world a bunch of famous comic minds. Mm. And then later, of course, there was Beyond the Fringe, which had been a big success on the British stage. So this, I would have imagined they would have seen the potential in this.
Well, The Goon Show, you have to remember, was always radio. It did have a television manifestation. It didn't really work. Because visualization of these characters,
they kept changing their voices also.
Yeah, I mean,
Peter Sellers could be six guys in the same skit.
Yes, but I mean, you could have done that on television. But anyway, it didn't work on television. Beyond the Fringe was very much a satirical show. The one thing that was very like Python was Spike Milligan's show Q5, which was happening about the same time. And Spike was...
But he was another gooner.
Yeah, he was another gooner. And Spike was playing with the form of television. And for instance, the costumes when you did a television show all had your name on and the character you were playing, and it was sort of pinned to your sleeve. And woe betide you if anyone ever went on. There was one story, someone had actually gone on doing a Shakespearean play with the tag still on their sleeve. Oh, but there was the worst crime ever. And of course Spike picked this up and had entire sketches done. Everybody had these labels on and they had little captions. After each guy said his line, he gave up his take-home pay for the week. And things like that were very much precursors of Python. And we very much admired Spike's stuff.
My guest is Michael Palin, whose diaries from 1969 to 1979, the Python years, have just been published in this country by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Judging from what you write here, nobody was really sure how this thing was going to work out. In fact, one of the names for the show was Bun, Wacket, Buzzard, Stubble, and Boot. And I suspect that with a complicated name like that, it just wouldn't have flown. But Monty Python's Flying Circus somehow just was thrown into the pot, and it's the one that took off?
What happened was we had come up with a number of very absurd ideas which bore no relation to what the show would be, because we didn't know what the show was going to be. We didn't want a title that pinned us down to anything. So it was kind of the toad elevating moment, a horse, a spoon in a bucket, the algae banging hour, crazy things. The BBC got extremely irritated and said, you've got to have something that bears some relationship to the titles we're used to. How about John Cleese's Flying Circus?
They wanted like John that. To be
they
the
liked the
star.
Flying Circus thing. They thought John could give his name to it, because John was by far the best known of all of us. We were relative unknowns. And John, quite rightly, didn't want to give his name to a series which may be a complete disaster. So we said in the end, can we... All right, we'll take the Flying Circus if we can come up with a name to go with it. And they said, okay. And we sat around one afternoon. We were much happier writing sketches, but someone said, no, we've got to get a title now. Come on, it's 3:30. We're going home soon. So what about a name that goes as so-and-so? And Python as a surname came up, Mr. Python. We liked that for some reason. Could he be Ken Python, Keith Python, Leonard Python, Michael Python, whatever? And suddenly someone came up, I think it might have been Eric, came up with Monty. And Monty Python made us laugh a lot at the time. This could have been hysteria, so we gave it 24 hours to then retell it. Went back to the BBC and said, we have a name. And they said, what is it? We said, Monty Python's Flying Circus. They just wasn't a titter. Their faces barely moved. And they said to us, well, I think you'll find in years to come, it'll be known as Flying Circus, and not Monty Python.
They were wrong.
They were wrong there.
Well, the BBC was wrong in so many levels here. They did not know what to do with this show.
But I have to say, no other broadcasting organization in the world would have put on Python at that time.
But is it also because it could be done on the cheap?
Yes.
And, you're constantly complaining about not having enough money and having to do other work.
Yes, I mean,
to survive.
We thought it could be done on the cheap. We didn't realize quite how cheaply the BBC considered it could be done. I mean, Terry Gilliam, I can't remember, he had £200 a week for everything to make all his animation. So he did it all himself. He didn't have an assistant. He had to sort of cut out the figures, do all that, move them together. Brilliant, really.
Today, with a computer, he could do it a lot easier. But
well, yes.
Then he had to do it the old-fashioned way.
In those days, he was doing old-fashioned, exactly, cut-out animation.
And when it first came out, they just kept on moving it to different time slots. Was there any positive response in the early days? Were there people who were saying, this is the most brilliant new comedy show to come along in years?
Yes, there were a few people who said, this is really new and really different. I think there were more people who said, what is this embarrassment? You know, and after the first recording, I can remember people who we knew quite well, who were embarrassed, didn't know what to say, had a quick drink at the bar afterwards, and they said, we've got to go home now. But there were one or two people who did see it, including George Harrison of the Beatles, who sent a telegram to us. You could send telegrams at that time. Mm-hmm. You can't in England anymore. Saying
anywhere,
how much you'd liked it. And we never got the telegram. And George told us about this about 8 years later. And I think because any one of the Beatles was so well known at that time, that a message saying, I love you all, George Harrison, the guy at the BBC, who said, well, this is obviously a hoax, and thrown it away. So there were George, and there was actually an American commentator called Fred Friendly, who mm-hmm. you may know, who wrote a very, very...
Edward R. Murrow's producer.
Was it right?
Yes.
I mean, he wrote a piece in, I think it might have been the Washington Post or something like that, quite early on, saying there was this wonderful show that was in England, and that amazed us.
Well, I guess in history is kinder to everyone in this regard. We remember it as an instantaneous success. Everybody just thought it was brilliant. It came over to the United States immediately. Of course, none of that is true. It didn't even come to the United States until after you had completed your run in England.
Yeah. Oh, it came to the States quite late on. We had tried. Various people, encouraged by people like Fred Friendly, had tried to market it in the States. And our first film, and now for something completely different, was really a rehash of some of the sketches filmed to get us round America having to buy the television series, which they clearly wouldn't. Let's make a movie which we can show.
And so the movie came first in this country?
Yep, and also, but first of all, were the Monty Python albums, which were picked up by Buddha Records here and released. And so a lot of people in America just heard Monty Python first on rock shows. They would play little sketches in between, you know, whatever. It was the Genesis, or no, it wouldn't be Genesis then, but the rock and roll stuff. But I think in 1975, I can't remember, I should know being a diarist, but it was around about 75 that it appeared on Dallas Public PBS. And then it did take off, and it took off very, very quickly. By which we'd given up hope by then, but it really moved around the states fast after that.
But New Yorkers are embarrassed to know that Dallas did it before New York. Well, it became a big success here anyway.
I think that was a very Pythonic thing that it should start in Dallas, of all places.
But. Well, people were listening to the shows, as you said, first on radio. And let's listen to one of the most famous sketches from the series, the Dead Parrot sketch, featuring Michael Palin and John Cleese. We are talking about Michael's diaries from 1969 to 1979, the Python years, published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Here's the Dead Parrot sketch, and then who knows where we'll go.
I wish to make it complete.
Sorry, we're closing for lunch.
Never mind that, my lad. I wish to complain about this parrot what I purchased not half an hour ago from this very boutique.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian Blue. What's wrong with it?
I'll tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead. That's what's wrong with it.
No, it's resting. Look.
Look, my lad, I know a dead parrot when I see one, and I'm looking at one right now.
No, it's not dead. It's resting.
Resting?
Yeah. Remarkable bird, the Norwegian Blue. Beautiful plumage, isn't it?
The plumage don't enter into it. It's stone dead.
No, it's resting.
All right, then. If it's resting, I'll wake it up. Hello, Polly. I got a nice cuttlefish for you when you wake up, Polly Parrot.
There, it moved.
No, it didn't. That was you pushing the gate.
I did not.
Yes, you did. Hello, Polly. Polly. Polly Parrot, wake up. Polly. Now, that's what I call a dead parrot.
No, it's stunned.
Look, my lad, I've had just about enough of this. That parrot is definitely deceased. And when I bought it not half an hour ago, you assured me that its lack of movement was due to it being tired and shagged out after a long squawk.
From tree to tree as they float down the mighty rivers of British Columbia. The giant redwood, the larch, the fir, the mighty Scots pine, the smell of fresh-cut timber, the crash of mighty trees. With my best girlie by my side, we'd sing, sing, sing. I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night, I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesdays I go shopping and have buttered scones for tea.
He cuts down trees, he eats his lunch, he goes to the lavatory. On Wednesdays he goes shopping and has buttered scones for tea. He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump. I like to press wildflowers. I put on women's clothing.
We're back with Michael Palin, whose diaries, 1969 to 1979, the Python years, have just been released in this country by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. And we were listening to his performance of the Lumberjack song. And, Michael, you were breaking up. In fact, you were breaking up during the dead rabbit bit.
Dead rabbit. Yeah.
Dead rabbit. Well, that's a whole other thing.
I missed something. I knew I missed something.
That was a pregnant pause.
Yes,
this is still funny, right?
Yeah.
Even for you, and you must have heard these things a billion times.
Yes. I mean, I haven't heard that for a while, but it is funny. I mean, we thought it was funny when we wrote it. It's, I don't see why we should kind of stop laughing now, but it's just little memories I have. And it's interesting, when you were playing the dead parrot, I wonder which version it was, because there was quite a lot of audience reaction there, people laughing and cheering. When we first did that sketch in a television studio, I think program 4 or 5 of the first series, it's actually very few people laughing. It's quite muted. Muted.
Made a moot point there.
The rabbit. Anyway, the... I'll not forget that. But the one voice you could hear, the one laugh you could hear, was this wonderful voice of John's wife, Connie, then, you know, who went to Faulty Towers, and she had this terrific laugh, it was not a sort of intake of breath. It was kind of... like someone choking to death in the audience. And you could hear Connie laughing on the dead parrot sketch, and that was about all the first time we did it. So this was a stage version when it had become famous, and everybody said, you know, sort of, it had been canonized.
Well, do you think that people learned that they could laugh at this sort of thing? Because it wasn't punchline humor.
No.
It was situational humor.
Yeah. Well, I think something happened. It became a kind of... A certain popularity accrued to some of the material, like Dead Parrot and Lumberjack. So it was a kind of celebratory thing. It wasn't anything too analytical. Let's listen to this. It's not like sort of playing Pinter or something like that. This was something that was rousing, rather like singing a song that you know well.
There was the Cheese Shop and other ones. They all became classics.
Yes.
Well, how were these sketches always scripted, or was there a certain amount of improvisation to them?
No, the improvisation was in the writing. By the time we got to performing them, they had to be fairly set, because the cameras and all the studio people had to know where to go and when to pick up things and when to have us in shot. So there was a certain amount of ad-libbing when we were filming, but most of the time when we were in the studio, we had the lines down and it was pretty straightforward.
Did everyone come up with ideas and then discuss them in meetings? Did you decide, we'll use that, but that other thing doesn't sound like it'll work?
Yeah, well, it was like having a little sort of filter bed, because there were 6 of us, and we would write in our separate groups. I wrote most of my material with Terry, although the diaries do show me writing with John one time, and there was a bit of sort of promiscuous activity amongst the writers, writing with each other. But
the Dead Parrot sketch, which you did with John, wasn't necessarily written with John?
No, that was written by John and Graham. Yeah. I was just always cast as a shopkeeper, because I could play these sort of characters that would irritate John no end. And then, you know, we would bring in our offerings and then sit round the table, and there would be the reading, and John would read his material that he'd written with Graham, and I would read the material I'd written with Terry, and Eric would read his material. And if everybody laughed, that went into the A pile, and that was that. And then the things which people liked bits of but thought it doesn't quite work here, that was handed on to another writing group to work. So they were sort of really genuinely collaborative. And then there were things we just wrote while we were sitting around the table.
You include a lot of descriptions of hotels you stayed in while we were filming on location. And food and drink play a large part in this story.
I know. Sad.
But is that because these are the things that really come to mind when you're doing something like this? At the time, I'm sure you weren't thinking, oh, we had a brilliant writing session today, Terry and I. You're more likely to write what you did after you wrote, and you went to dinner and somebody was being raucous at the next table.
It was very difficult to keep in the diary the process of writing. So, you know, Lumberjack Song, something like that. I'm afraid there's no hard evidence that we ever wrote Lumberjack Song, because he did it and that was that. And so then I would talk about going to the pub, or Terry and I playing a game of squash or something like that. But the hotels were weirdly interesting, especially in Torquay, where I described staying one night at a hotel called Glen Eagles when we were filming there. And the man who ran it was so intolerably awful that Graham and Terry Jones and myself left the next day. John stayed on, and of course,
Faulty Towers.
Yes, made this man into a sort of 20th century icon, and Fawlty Towers was written about that. And
in fact, John left early. He wasn't in the last season, was he?
No, we did three series, but John was wanting to go after the midway through the second series. He was restless. He wanted to try other things. I think he thought that we'd taken Python as far as we could go. And the others of us said, no, I think there's life in it. But in some ways, he was right. I think a lot of the best stuff was in the first series and the first half of the second series.
Well, you get the feeling that you kept on pushing at the envelope year after year, daring people to say, you can't go that far.
Yes. I think that's what
And that happened in the movies as well.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't think of ourselves absolutely as naughty boys, but the subversive element was important. What wouldn't they like us to write? Let's write that. But alongside it, and I think it's very, very important, is the kind of surreal, goony side of Python, which I think sometimes takes the curse off some of the harder material. And there's a kind of joyfulness to Python, which I think is why it's lasted and why children 9 or 10 are rediscovering it. Because actually it is, in an odd way, quite innocent. There's some hard stuff. But, I mean, the idea of Python trying to sort of destroy the world and attack all the institutions, the fearless anti-establishment Python, I mean, it doesn't really hold up. We were very silly people, and very silly people like us.
And did silly walks and silly everything else. But in the diaries, we get the political events of the time, the IRA bombings in London, Watergate, the first walk on the moon. They all show up along with the births of your children, illnesses, the passing of your father. Mm. So, because those were all the things that you were contending with at the same time that you were creating the show.
Exactly. But the diaries were really intended to be a record of my daily life. And, you know, if I went to the dentist and had some horrible work done, I wrote that down and put it in the diaries. Some people probably don't like that, but I think anyone who's ever had any dentistry will say, oh, yes, he had it too. So you've got to have a fairly... you've got to be... I thought when I was actually editing the diaries down, I've got to give the broad story. It can't focus in on one kind of activity. It's got to be how we lived. And some days we wrote great Python sketches. Other days we were just worried about bank accounts and doing adverts.
In fact, the diaries concentrate a lot on the business aspects of running the troupe. It seems that it was a lot easier to do the show than to haggle over contracts.
Yeah.
And we mentioned earlier that you didn't make a lot of money. Were you able to cash in other ways? Because you'd become famous. The BBC wasn't giving you all that much money. Were other people coming to you and saying, we want you, Michael, because everybody knows your voice and knows your face?
Oddly enough, Python didn't... It's a good, very good question. I never really thought of that. But it didn't give rise to an awful lot of work through Monty Python, because I think people are a little frightened of Python. And either you hired the whole Python team to do something, and we did do odd things like hairspray commercials, which Graham and Eric and myself and I think John did some of them as well. That was a group thing. But as individuals, people sort of said, well, you've got certain strengths that were there before Python or later. I mean, I got offered an acting role in Three Men in a Boat adaptation, which was directed by Stephen Frears and written by Tom Stoppard. And that was purely as being an actor. That was nothing to do with Python, I don't think. So, oddly enough, Python had to give itself work. You know, it's very interesting. I never thought of it that way.
So you started making these films, and there were records, there were books, there were live stage shows. I think the Dead Parrot that we heard was probably from a live stage show instead of from the TV show.
Yeah.
Because you needed to make some real income, I suspect. You give us a detailed account of the filming of The Holy Grail and The Life of Brian. And although you're very diplomatic, we do get a sense of personal conflicts in the group, mainly with Graham Chapman, who comes across as an unreliable alcoholic. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, it was true.
Graham, well, at what point did you realize
Graham
that he had a real problem?
Graham was an alcoholic and he was unreliable, but he, oddly enough, of course, he never accepted he was an alcoholic until the very end of his drinking days, when it was either life or death and he had to decide to give up. Before that, it was just Graham enjoyed a drink. And we all did. You know, I'm not... Well, not... No, I think John did as much. But anyway, most of us sat around the bar with Gray very happily. We had some very good times. I think it's a shame if Graham comes out as someone who was unexciting or dull or just a
I wasn't bore. Saying that.
No, but he wasn't a boring alcoholic. We had great fun. But he was unreliable with lines, sometimes with sketches. Some things just had to be abandoned because he couldn't get the lines right. And once Graham, you know, dried out, and he did a whole of The Life of Brian, he was on the wagon then, and he was terrific, and is terrific. He's a great actor. You see all the things Graham's done. He was very good as Arthur in Grail, but he was more frightened then and tended to take a drink to calm him down. But there's a bit in the diary where I talk about the first day's filming of Holy Grail, and how Graham's up on the mountain shaking. And I said, this seems so odd, because Graham was a great mountaineer, and, you know, it's a pipe-smoking adventurer, loved climbing. And many, many years later, you know, like the innocent I was, Graham said, you know, I had the DTs. I'd been drinking so much because I was frightened of what I was going to have to do in the film. I was shaking. It was the DTs that got me then. But we all, in our very British way, didn't really see it as excessive. It was just someone who enjoyed a drink.
I mentioned that you were pushing on the envelope as the years went on, but you also suggest that the BBC became considerably more concerned about matters of censorship than that they were allowed you a lot more leeway at the beginning. Is it because of a change of management, or because the show had become so important that they were aware that there might be more repercussions?
Well, when we were making the first series, we were given a small budget and we were taken off whenever there was a Horse a Year show on or something like that. They didn't bother to really listen. And gradually, I think, over the progress of the second series, they realized that quite a lot of people were talking about Python, writing about Python, and maybe we should have a look at this. And we might have been pushing the envelope a bit, but we had ludicrous bits of censorship. My favorite one was coming to go to the BBC because they had stopped us from using the word masturbation. And it was in a sketch about, it's called the Summarised Proust Competition, where people had to summarise Proust's masterwork in 15 seconds. Bong, and off you go. And they go, it begins with, Swan, come, bong, sorry. But anyway, they asked people what they did, you know, for what their hobbies were, because people used to do that on shows. And one man said his hobbies were strangling animals, golf, and masturbation. And this was recorded. And before it went out, there was a week's gap before it went out, the BBC called us together and said, we just can't say this. And then we had a stupid, which is in the diaries, we met with the BBC executive. We had six pythons around the table and him sitting there and us saying, why can't we say masturbation? But he insisted it should be cut. And in the final show, out went the lines, what are your hobbies? Strangling animals, golf. There was a short pause and then terrific laughter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the laughter from masturbation was there for sort of strangling animals and golf. So it sounds quite bizarre. But
was there more censorship once it came over here?
No. I mean, PBS took the show as they were, made no changes. When ABC wanted to try and pick up the shows, and they took the last series of six without John and made them into two 90-minute specials and took about 8 minutes out of each program, partly for commercial breaks, but partly to appease the Federal Standards and Practices people. And it was so bad, and we felt so cheated and so embarrassed for ourselves with our cult audience in the States, that Terry and I actually were able to take a court action. And just near here in Foley Square, you know, Terry Gilliam and I came over to defend our sketches in a court of law.
John went on to do Fawlty Towers and other movies. You've acted in a number of films, written books. You've done your travel shows, which have brought you here, and also books. Terry Gilliam has directed quite a few films, some big hits, some bombs. Eric Idle created Spam-a-Lot. Where are you going from here? Are you going to do another travel series?
I have just done another travel series, which airs in 2 weeks in the UK. It's called New Europe, and it's really the Eastern European countries and the way they've proliferated, and the countries after independence, how Europe is changing from the East rather than from the West. So that's all happening soon, and there's a book to go with that.
Michael Palin will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store at the Lincoln Triangle. Tomorrow you can catch him on the 92nd Street Y at 8 o'clock. And the book we've been talking about is Michael Palin Diaries, 1969-1979, The Python Years, published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you again so much for being with us.
Thanks, Leonard.
On tomorrow's show, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich explains why he feels that capitalism's gains have come at a cost to democracy. Then Alan Alda shares some of his answers to life's big questions, plus a look at the work of Sessue Hayakawa, who was a silent film star long before he was nominated for an Oscar for his role in The Bridge on the River Kwai, and how number crunching can affect everyday life in ways you might not expect. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeshick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Paula Crossfield, Brad Ludlow, Barbara Kahn, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.